and thanks for turning on The Blender, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's weekly podcast. I'm Bruce Jacobs, a producer at RFARL, and I'll be your host this week. In this episode, a hacking expert talks about what is behind a series of recent internet attacks on corporations and government institutions around the world.
What's really going on here is there's a group of people my age, in their 40s and 50s, a small group at the core, that are recruiting young children and using them as disposable weapons.
In our Different Beat segment, a master of the Gothic harp takes a break from her European tour to explain her instrument and her music. But first, a story that might upset the reset between the United States and Russia. This week, the U.S. State Department put a number of Russian officials on a visa blacklist, provoking anger from Moscow. The action was taken to punish those alleged to be involved in the death of Sergei Magnitsky. The lawyer was investigating massive corruption by state officials when he himself was accused of crimes and put in pretrial detention. He died there in what Russian government investigators called abusive conditions. Magnitsky worked for Bill Browder, once the largest U.S. investor in Russia, but who is now barred from the country. Browder has waged a worldwide campaign for justice in the Magnitsky case. He talked to correspondent Irina Lagunina after the announcement of the State Department action.
How did you know about the fact that that Hillary Clinton confirmed has imposed sanctions on Russian officials?
We read the story in the Washington Post late last night, where the confirmation of these visa sanctions was first reported. I had heard rumors about this for some time, but it wasn't confirmed until the Washington Post story that came out late last night.
Can you remind the history of the creation of Cardin list?
It goes back all the way until 2009. In the summer of 2009, Senator Cardin, who is chairman of the U.S. Helsinki Commission, invited me to testify about the lack of rule of law in Russia. And I told the story of what happened with the police raiding our companies, of taking our documents, of stealing the taxes, $230 million of taxes that we paid. And then I told the story about how Sergei Magnitsky, our lawyer, testified against those officers and was arrested and put in jail. And at the time that I testified, it was the summer of 2009, and Sergei was still alive. And so Senator Cardin then became concerned about Sergei Magnitsky. He became one of our friends and partners in trying to find ways of putting pressure on the Russian government to release Sergei as a hostage. And so when Senator Cardin was emotionally invested in the story from early on, and like all of us, when Sergei died, he was heartbroken, just like I was and just like everybody else close to Sergei, because anyone involved in his and Sergei's situation couldn't have been anything other than just devastated. And so afterwards, he was quite eager to find a way of really doing something significant in this case. And in April of 2010, we got together and we looked at a number of different options. And one of the options that was available at the time was the idea of visa sanctions. And so we put together literally hundreds, if not 1,000 pages of evidence showing Senator Cardin and his team the role that different people played in the death of Sergei Magnitsky. And we showed him documents with people's signatures on them. And off the back of that, they created a list of 60 people who have signatures on documents causing Sergei problems. So, for example, the people who denied him medical attention, they were on the list. We have their signatures. The people who fabricated evidence to get him arrested, they were on the list. We have their signatures. And off the back of that, there was a list created of 60 people that Senator Cardin then put into Hillary Clinton requesting that they be banned from entering the United States. But he didn't just stop there. He then put together a piece of legislation called the Justice for Sergei Magnitsky Act, which would actually bypass the State Department, where the Congress would just make this decision. And the Justice for Sergei Magnitsky Act then became the Sergei Magnitsky Rule of Law Accountability Act, which is now being considered by the Congress, in which 20 senators have co-sponsored it. And this piece of legislation freezes assets, bans visas, And it doesn't just touch Sergei's case, it also touches other gross human rights violation cases in Russia. And the piece of news that we got today is that in response to this new piece of legislation, the State Department has said to Senator Cardin, okay, we've already banned these people that you asked for. Isn't that enough? And I think that the Senate's response is, thank you very much for banning them. No, that's not enough. We want to go further. We want to freeze their assets, and we want this to apply not just to the Magnitsky case, but to other terrible cases of human rights violations.
As far as I know, Polish position was that they will introduce the same sanctions as the visa ban if the United States take this move. Do you expect any further actions right now from European countries?
Indeed, I view this. There's a whole domino theory to these visa sanctions, and as you rightly pointed out, Poland had made that statement quite a while ago. And it's not just Poland. We've been in touch with a number of other countries all over Europe, and I would expect that because the United States has done this, it gives everybody else the confidence to do it as well, and you'll see many other countries doing this. I don't think that these 60 people who killed Sergei Magnitsky or were involved in this terrible crime will be able to travel much other than to really uncivilized places in the future.
What is the precondition there? What should the Russia do in order to take those people off the list and to avoid the sanctions against those personages?
Well, I think at this point there's nothing they can do to avoid sanctions of people who are involved in torture and murder. I think that what they can do in terms of not having this happen in many other cases is to clean up their judicial system and prosecute all these people. I mean, it's absurd that the United States says these people are torturers and murderers, they can't come into our country, and in Russia these same people are being promoted and given state honors and with no consequence at all to their crimes. And so, I mean, if Russia wants to be a respected country in the international community, they have to start punishing torturers and murderers, particularly ones where there's so much evidence and they're so obviously corrupt.
That was correspondent Irina Lagunina's interview with U.S. investor Bill Browder. The hacker groups Lulzsec and Anonymous announced this week they'd broken into the website of Italy's cyber police. They published sensitive information they collected, saying it was revenge for the recent arrests of hackers in the United States and Europe. The hacker collectives have been on a virtual crime spree this year against banks, corporations, and governments, but arrests haven't seemed to slow them down. The editor of our English language website, Luke Allnut, spoke about the issue with Sam Bown, an expert who teaches a course on ethical hacking at City College San Francisco.
Sam, I really wanted to talk about ethical hacking, as I see that you teach a class on this. So I really wanted to begin by just asking, what is ethical hacking?
It's very simple. You do all the same thing the bad guys do, except you get the permission of the victim first. So you're doing it to find the problems in security and patch it before the bad guys do. But other than that, you're supposed to know as much as possible all the rotten things you can do to computers that the bad guys know.
Just turning to denial of service attacks, which seem to be the tactic of choice recently for some of these script kids. Do you see that as digital vandalism or more akin to a cyber sit-in?
Well, I really don't think much of the sit-in analogy. A lot of people say that Anonymous is morally and legally justified to take down sites with denial of service. The difference between that and a sit-in is that in a sit-in, you are physically present and you permit the police to arrest you. And here is where I think Anonymous reveals their complete lack of moral fiber. If you really want to protest the law and you want to break the law, Gandhi and Martin Luther King showed how to do this. You stand up in public with your real name and you let the police arrest you for doing something like blocking traffic. And then this causes a public examination of why you did that and whether your cause is important. But these guys hide on the internet, take down a site and run away so they escape the punishment. And that creates fear because people justifiably think that they could be the next victim. It shows a lack of commitment. They don't even put their real name on anything, and they're not willing to take any consequences. And it shows a lack of moral purity. And I think it's very clear that, in fact, they do not choose their victims carefully. They just want to hurt somebody, like an angry street gang, and they get together and just pick someone who appears to be unpopular at the moment to be their latest victim. And when they run out of victims, they do like what LulzSec did. They just opened a phone line so anybody could call in and they'll attack anybody whose name appears on the phone line.
Right.
Because the fun is the fight. It's not like they actually have a cause or any principle or any goal. They just like attacking things on the internet. It's just a game to them.
When I've spoken to anonymous activists before, and I have raised the sit-in analogy, and they've said that actually they do put themselves on the line and they are at risk of being punished. And as we've seen recently, Anonymous and LulzSec activists have been arrested. So they're arguing actually that what they're doing, their hacktivism, is actually that it does face the consequences of punishment.
Well, they're just like any other criminal. They take every possible effort to protect themselves, and occasionally they fail and go to prison. I mean, they are breaking the law, but their moral position is terrible. And if you go to the pages where you download the Low Orbit Ion Cannon, their tool of choice, it actually contains the statements that you will not get caught, because when the attack starts, the server will crash and the logs will be lost, and you can always claim that you just were infected by a virus. And those statements are all absolutely false. And anybody with any knowledge of computer security can instantly spot them as false, and they tell teenagers to do it. And what's really going on here is there's a group of people my age, in their 40s and 50s, a small group at the core, that are recruiting young children and using them as disposable weapons, tricking them into doing attacks, and then letting them go down. So, I mean, it really is morally deplorable. And that's why it got me involved in being a strong vocal opponent of this, because the people they're hurting are like my students. Some of my young students might fall for this and participate, feel like they're saving the world, and then discover that now they can't get a legitimate job anymore because they've been busted for computer crime. And I just hate to see it. You know, it's taking people who are idealistic but naive and could be productive and deflecting them into a world of crime.
Do you really think that groups like Anonymous and LulzSec, do you really think they are run by a very small core of, I don't want to call them activists, but a small core of hackers?
Oh, yes. I think absolutely that is correct in both cases. Now, Anonymous is so very low-tech that there are just groups using the name that are not led by people, but there are a small number of leaders that have really come out that set rules and such. I think they don't have a lot of authority, so there are a bunch of splinter factions. But LulzSec doesn't pretend anything else. I mean, there are only six of them, and three or four that have sort of drifted away, and they know who they are, they've been well-profiled, and they have public identities, all under fake names, of course, but, I mean, there's no question, they're not even much of a group. There's just six people doing it, and then a bunch of people cheering them on, or condemning them.
Do you think that, I mean, when I read the tech press, I often find that the tone of the coverage about groups like Anonymous tends to be either sometimes positively cheerleady, and perhaps other times, if not cheerleady, but certainly less than perhaps as critical as perhaps I think it should be. Have you noticed that in the tech press as well?
Oh, yes, and I think it's easy to understand. They are afraid.
They
don't want to be the next target.
Do you think it just comes down to fear, or do you think it comes down to perhaps the way that hackers are somehow, you know, for the digerati, the hackers are the digital rock stars of the day. They're the Che Guevara. And, you know, there's some sort of mystique about their technical prowess, that they can do things. So is it just fear, or is it a bit of both, do you think?
If anybody has any admiration for the technical prowess of Anonymous, they've got to be out of their mind. I mean, Anonymous doesn't know anything. The Low Orbit Ion Cannon is a piece of junk, and they can't even hack into a server with a SQL exploit. Now, LulzSec has made it up to being only about 15 years out of date in their computer security knowledge. They know how to run one or two automated tools that dump the contents of vulnerable servers, and they are improving rapidly. There's a school for LulzSec that publishes the techniques of crime they use, and I've been studying those. Some of those are interesting and perhaps worth using as homework for my students. But none of these guys have any technically advanced skills. They're just doing stuff that anybody in their right mind would be smart enough not to do for non-technical reasons. like, you know, attacking NATO and the FBI, you're just out of your mind. You're just going to go to prison and accomplish no good. And everybody else can see that. They're just the people that are too mentally, you know, ethically deranged to see that they're destroying themselves.
That was Luke Allnut's interview with hacking expert Sam Bowne. You're listening to Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's weekly podcast. This week on A Different Beat, correspondent Ron Sinovitz speaks with soprano Hanna Blazikova about a special instrument she plays, a Gothic harp based on 14th century designs from Central Europe. Blazikova tours the world singing Baroque music with some of the world's finest orchestras, but one of her greatest musical passions is to resurrect long-forgotten, authentic Gothic songs.
Welcome to A Different Beat. We're here with Hanna Blazikova, a virtuoso on the Gothic harp, also a soprano, singing Gothic music, authentic Gothic music. Your Gothic harp, it's a beautiful instrument. Can you tell us a little bit about the differences between this Gothic harp and a modern harp?
We all know the modern harps, those big instruments with seven pedals. But these instruments of Gothic times, they are from like 14th, 15th century, that were used for accompanying singers or to be played in the courts of kings, and very courtly instruments, very aristocratic. What is difference in between the big harp and this small harp? Of course, the size and the number of strings. They have around 25, 30 strings, the Gothic harps. The strings should be made of guts or wire, but I have carbon strings. It's something like in between. I love the sound of it because it sounds like bells a little bit, so I can play a lot of different types of music on it. Another difference is the space in between the strings is much smaller than on a normal concert harp. So when I first came to this harp and I tried to play it, it took me really months to learn to play it because I used to use the whole finger to play with. And now I need to use just the very tiny fingertips to play this harp because the whole finger just doesn't fit there.
When I look at some concert harps, I notice that there could be two or even three rows of strings, but this harp only has one row.
It's something different. Actually, the three rows of strings is Baroque harp. It's Baroque Italian harp called tripla. It was used for continuo playing in the groups like Monteverdi and this kind of music. It had one big advantage, the chromatic, because the middle row is just chromatic tones, and on the sides you have the diatonic.
So chromatic tones, meaning the black and white keys of the piano,
right.
And the diatonic meaning
right.
just the white keys of the piano.
Exactly.
So this is a diatonic tuning then?
This is diatonic tuning, but to make it more possible for me to play some later medieval music, I asked this harp builder to put those levers on my harp, which is not authentic at all, but makes my life much easier.
So can you give us a little sample of this diatonic?
Okay, so diatonic, you can play in a different modus.
Really beautiful. It really has beautiful tones, and when I'm listening to it, it's rather a very woody and strong attack plucked sound. How would you say that differs from a concert harp?
Big concert harps today have a much bigger sound because you have to hear them very far in a big auditorium. So this harp was used more in the court. The sound doesn't have to be that big, but you're right, it has sort of very plucked sound. But you know what? Even the medieval harps, they had sometimes buzzers on a resonator that made the sound even more like buzzing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what was the ideal of medieval music. You can also hear a little bit on this harp. The tone is so straight.
This harp would have been an ancestor of a later Renaissance harp that would have evolved into these orchestral or concert harps.
Harp is one of the oldest instruments in the world. It was invented very independently in almost all the parts of the world. So you could find it in Africa, Asia, not so much today, but in ancient times, there were a lot of different harps. And of course, Europe. First, it was like bow harp, just simple, like bow with few strings. And you can find these harps already like 4,000 years before century in Egypt, and old Persia in 3,000 years. Considering the European harp, we have a lot of depictions and references to harps in old manuscripts and sculpture from like 8th century in Europe, and always was very aristocratic, used for kings and leaders of clans in Celtic area, Gaelic area, and in Balkan and everywhere in Tyrol. It was really widespread all over the Spanish Empire. Of course, the first harps were very small. You could hold it on your lap. And then the size got bigger and bigger. This Gothic harp came that is already quite tall. Then the bigger Renaissance harp, then the Baroque harps with first just one line of strings, then two lines of strings, then three lines of strings. Then there was much more need for a chromatic harp, so all different kinds of chromatic harps that have just too many strings to play. And then we got to pedal harps.
Now, for people who don't know what the functions are of a pedal on such a harp, what are you using the pedals for? Could you explain?
There are 7 pedals on harp. Each pedal is for every note in each octave. So you have 1 pedal for C, all the Cs on harp, 1 pedal for D, E, and so on. It makes it actually higher. So
raise it to,
yeah, you can raise it half tone. Actually, the concert harps you can raise twice. But I also can quite change some tonality if I want, while playing to. So I can even play and change the tonalities too, but I need my left hand to be free at least for 1/4 note.
You're pulling these levers that really weren't part of originally the Gothic design, so in a way you're using the form of the pedal with these levers,
right,
that you had installed.
Yeah.
Your love for the ancient music, in a way it's put you on a quest to revive some music that's maybe lost from humanity. You're actually resurrecting lost music with your performances.
Yeah. Mostly there's only melody line left from all these medieval songs, beautiful songs, sometimes not even complete or just a poem and a reference to another song. You have to combine these and then you get the song. What I'm trying to do is to find some fitting, nice accompaniment with my harp that is also in the style, of course, of the music of those times. So you cannot use things like we're used to today, like chords or some harmony, because there was no harmony in those days. Everything was played in different moduses. Can I show examples?
Sure.
Quien servi Santa Maria, for example, that I played now. It goes like Quien servi Santa Maria, Señor muy verdadera, que tu danza guarda que le voy a mentirira. And then you can find another melody with it to play along in chords and quints. So it's Quien servi Santa Maria, Señor muy verdadera, que tu danza guarda que le voy a mentirira. It's moving in between two moduses. So you must find where to change to chords and where to change to quints. And in some music, you can also use sixths. Italian music of 14th century or English music of 14th century, you can already use like six these. But it's quite rare.
You're touring the world, really, as a musician. You're traveling to Japan, the United States, all over Europe.
Singer, mostly.
But you're performing in cathedrals that were built in Gothic times or in rooms that are Gothic sound chambers.
You know, mostly I travel as a singer. I sing a lot of Baroque music in those big churches from Gothic times and Baroque times. So very rarely I play my harp there. But of course, sometimes I happen to have a concert with my harp in a church or a very nice Gothic house or something. And of course, it feels great. It fits in there. The architecture and music connect, and it's really nice. It feels good.
That was Hanna Blažíková in our studio in Prague. And that's all we have for this week. I'm Bruce Jacobs. Thanks for turning on the blender from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. To close this week's program, Hanna Blažíková plays her Gothic harp and sings a song from the 1400s that she performed on her latest European tour.
I just returned from France, where I had this concert of Cantigas de Santa Maria, which is my favorite piece because it's a huge collection from like the end of 13th century Spain. Thank you. las rosas e flor das flores donadas, donadas, Señor das Señores.
Senhor das Senhores.